Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. Presented by Belco Credit Union. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Good evening, everyone. Good evening. What a nice party we're having tonight. Well, on behalf of the Tattered Cover Bookstore, it is my pleasure to welcome you and to thank you for supporting your local independently owned bookstore, because without your support, we simply would not exist. And it always gives us great pleasure to welcome an author who lives, works, and writes in our community. But we beam with pride when we can welcome home one of Tattered Cover's own. Our former colleague, Carlene Bryce, is the author of two previous works of nonfiction and the editor of an anthology. Last year saw the publication of her critically acclaimed, award-winning, best-selling debut novel, Orange, Mint, and Honey. Yeah. And we know that Carlene has sold the film rights, so please cross your fingers that we see that project come to fruition. So tonight, we are so very proud to welcome Carlene Bryce back to the Tattered Cover to present her second novel, Children of the Waters. Would you please join me in congratulating Carlene?
Thank you. This it feels so silly because I think I know almost everybody in the room. And so it seems kind of stupid to be talking at a microphone to friends and family and coworkers and former coworkers and people that I volunteer with. And so, but bear with me. This is how it works. I have to, you know, put on the thing when I do the thing. So thank you all for coming. I'm so delighted to see all your faces. There's lots of people I met at book clubs here, and there's also a lot of other authors here. Colorado is genuinely blessed with prolific writers. I belong to an organization called the Literary Ladies Luncheon, and some of my writer friends in that group are here, so I just want to point out a few people. Kim Reed is here. Kim has a memoir called No Place Safe, which is excellent. Came out last year. Yay, Kim. Let's see. J.D. Mason is here, who has how many novels? About six, going on half a million. We didn't even know we were here all this time. We've both been writing until she tracked me down after seeing me in Essence last year. And so we've become good friends. And a lot of the book club ladies know JD's work, but I recommend you all check it out because she's a very, very good writer. I have some show and tells here. Doreen Orion is in the back with her memoir, Queen of the Road, which came out last year. During this came out last year, and it's what, and it's 5 millionth printing or something like that about now. Just six. Okay, just it's six printing. And it's the story of her and her husband, and the true tale of 47 states, 22,000 miles, 200 shoes, two cats, one poodle, and a bus with the will of its own. So they went on a trip. And then Deborah Fine is here, and Deborah is a speaker and a writer. Oh, there's Deborah. And she has a couple of books out. The Fine Art of the Small Talk and The Fine Art of the Big Talk. So when you want to talk big, she can help you. When you want to talk small, she can help you too. And she introduced me to somebody who I'd heard a lot about but never met until tonight, Rachel Greenwald, who's also a writer and writes books that some of you ladies might be interested in. Her new one, is it out now? Okay. Her new one is called Why He Didn't Call You Back. 1,000 guys reveal what they really thought about you after your date. personally, I would never want to know. But if you're brave enough, check out her book. And let's see, Karen Carter's here. She has a book called One Sister Song. I was going to say My Sister Song. One Sister Song, which is a lovely novel about actually two sisters. And it has some themes similar to Children of the Waters about interracial families and things like that. So I would recommend that you check that out. So we can get started now. Oh, Andrea. Andrea's here. Andrea has a book called Blessing in Disguise that has a lot of different spiritual writings in it. It's an anthology that she edited and contributed to. And it has just essays, or does it have poetry as well?
Stories. There's all my poetry, other people's poetry.
There's poetry and stories, too. And it's a really good book. And it has 39 life lessons from today's greatest teachers. And Andrea's a friend from the LLL. So is that everybody that was in the LLL that has a book that I wanted to point out? These ladies have been quite a lifeline for me, so I'm happy to share with them and about them. And I won't do that because I'll be here all night. Because there's a lot of people that I want to say thank you very sincerely from the bottom of my heart for coming, that I've known a million years, haven't seen in a million years, and I'm really touched that you all could be here. And if I start naming names, we'll be here all night, so I won't do that. But anyway, the novel that we are here to talk about is called Children of the Waters. It came out at the end of June. And it is my second novel, as Charles said. It's a story about two women. One is white and one is black. And they find out that they're related. And you have to read the story to figure out how that works. I don't want to give too much away. But it's a story that I think is pretty timely, considering that for some reason, because of our new president, this country has discovered that there are people of different races here, you know? and all the media is going, hey, wow, there's all these different people. And sometimes they intermingle and create new people that are different too. Hey, we didn't know that. And so, maybe I have good timing, or maybe all that will, you know, be a flash in the pan. I hope not. I hope we continue to talk about the issue of race, especially since I think we're quick to celebrate, which is, you know, something that's truly amazing, our new president, our soon-to-be new Supreme Court justice, and a lot of really wonderful things that are happening in this country. But at the same time, we have things like, you know, little kids in Philadelphia who go to a pool and get kicked out because they're black in 2009. So that's kind of a bummer, to say the least. We've come a long way, baby, but we still have a little ways to go. And I hope that my work can be part of that moving forward. I grew up in Omaha, Nebraska, which is where my friend Crystal is from. Okay, I had to say one name. And I haven't seen her in a million years. I grew up in Omaha, Nebraska, and one of the funny things about that I know now is that in Omaha, we lived in neighborhoods where there were all kind of people. We went to schools with all kind of people and didn't think there was anything different about that. I went to school with kids who were Indians and kids who were black and kids who were white. We played on the same streets. We hung out at the same parks and went to the same schools, and I didn't know that was different until I went to college and met people from places like Chicago and St. Louis and stuff. And I knew a girl actually from St. Louis who had never been in a class with another white person her whole school career. And I just thought that was so strange. But then I was also in a class, it was the University of Kansas, and there were a lot of kids from Kansas who had never seen a black person in real life before either. So anyway, I like to brag about that with Omaha because people tend to think, you know, the coasts are so cool and, you know, the middle is the flyover country. And I think the middle has a lot going for it. And that's one of the things that the middle has going for it is that we mixed it up a little bit and therefore I think are a lot less afraid of each other and weirded out by each other and stuff. So I think that that formed my voice and allowed me to write this book. I'm going to read a little bit from it. And the background is, let's see, I'm going to read from a little bit from Billy's chapter. And Billy is a woman who is black and very connected to her ancestors and her family, and very much identifies as a black person, as an African-American woman. And it is in the course of the story that she finds out some family secrets that reveal that her family might not be who she thought they were. But this is how we get introduced to Billy. Billy Cousins shook exactly 7 drops of sunflower oil mixed with lavender and rose essential oils into the palms of her hands. Then she bowed her head. Grandmothers and grandfathers, please watch over me. Please watch over my man. Please watch over the child growing inside me who is of him and of me. Thank you for your wisdom. Thank you for your strength. Thank you for your protection. Ashe. We'll name our baby Ambada, she thought, to connect in Kiswahili. She said it out loud, Ambada, and anointed a pink candle with the blessing oil, pink the color of health and spiritual and familial love. She lit the candle and placed it on the low white cloth-covered table next to the stick that showed the word pregnant in its little window. Also on the makeshift altar were a glass of fresh water for purification, a cobalt blue bowl filled with cornmeal to feed the ancestors' spirits, a scallop shell representing the great mother from which we all come, a few copper pennies, an offering to the ancestors, and photos of her deceased grandparents and great aunts and uncles. Because Billy didn't have an actual photo of her great grandmother, the Cheyenne Indian who had passed down her long nose, narrow eyes, and white cheekbones to her, she had framed a picture of a Cheyenne girl taken by the famous Western photographer Edward S. Curtis. She lit a smudge stick, then left the bedroom and went to the living room. Starting at the front door, she waved the bundle of sage in the air. Even with the windows opened, the pungent aroma, reminiscent of marijuana, I've heard, only sweeter, filled her nose. She was clearing the house with smoke, opening windows so that any negative energy could escape, just as she had done 5 weeks ago, the night this baby was conceived. She knew now that what she was doing that night was opening the way for conception. Deep inside her, there had been a secret wish to have a baby. After she was diagnosed with lupus 9 years ago, she had stopped taking birth control pills and switched to a diaphragm, closely tracking her cycle. The night with the sage had been far enough after she ovulated that she should have been safe, so she left her diaphragm in the medicine cabinet. At least that's what she had told herself then, but now she had to admit that she had been hoping to tilt her world toward a change she had once thought she'd never want to make. Her sweetie Nick didn't want kids, and Billy wanted Nick. So when they got together, she told herself that teaching Head Start, spending 4 long days a week with preschoolers would fill any need for children. But she had only been 26 then and had no idea that only 6 years later, a wind would sweep through her empty room and set off so many bells inside her that it would seem as if every wind chime in the neighborhood was ringing. She wafted smoke over Nick's baby grand piano, the most expensive thing they owned. She kept it polished to a high sheen, and she could see her reflection in the dark wood. Nick was in Oakland at his father's funeral. Billy had wanted to go with him, but he wouldn't let her. He never told her why he left California or why he didn't stay in touch with his family. He hadn't seen his father in 15 years. The only thing he would say was that they put the funk in dysfunctional. Then he'd try to laugh it off, but she could tell he was hurt in some profound way. She smiled at herself and brushed a tuft of cat hair off the piano. Even though most of their stuff came from flea markets, garage sales, and thrift stores, their home pleased her. She had selected every stick of furniture, rug, plate, dish towel, woven basket, and piece of art with great care. She felt happy whenever she opened a drawer and everything was in its place. Sure, she was a little OCD. She and Nick had had their first fight when he set the table with mismatched napkins. But she didn't understand people who didn't care about their living space. You could tell a lot about people by the way they lived. For example, if she went into someone's home and they didn't have any real art, not even one small piece by a local artist, if they only had framed posters or stuff that looked like it had come from cheap motels, she knew these were people she didn't want to associate with. Bougie boho, Nick called her. And proud of it, she thought, moving one of the sofa pillows over just an inch before she went through the dining room kitchen and to the small second bedroom. Though there was an extra bed, they mostly used this room for storage. It was filled with their out-of-season clothes, the vacuum cleaner, bookcases with her old textbooks and books she read as a girl. They'd have to move all the junk to the basement to make space for a crib, and she'd make new curtains, seafoam green for Ambata. She returned to their bedroom and opened a window. She was starting to feel lightheaded, as if the sage really was weed. She smiled at the ways in which her body was already changing. She looked up at the full moon, the frog moon, some Native American tribes called April's moon. Then she waved the burning herbs over the bed, remembering Nick's long brown body underneath her, the desire for her in his eyes, how he smelled like almond oil from the massage she had given him, how he called out her name, his voice so deep, so hoarse, it made her skin flush now to think of it. She extinguished the smudge stick, pulled her hair into a ponytail. Billy had what her mother called Indian hair, meaning that compared to most black folks, the texture was fine, and since it curled more than it kinked, it was considered straight. And she knelt before her altar, excitement and anxiety rising in her. She had started speaking to the ancestors when she was 21 and her body turned on itself, her immune system attacking her own body's cells, causing fevers and unbelievable fatigue and making her joints ache like those of an elderly woman. At first, she thought she had a terrible flu, but the symptoms hung on longer than any flu. When a strange rash broke out on her face so that her nose and right cheek were almost as red as the port wine stain on her left cheek, she went to the doctor. Her parents had taken her to church every Sunday until she was 17, but religion never meant to her what it did to them. However, when the doctor told her she had an incurable disease, she felt so scared and alone that she needed someone, something outside of herself and fast. Getting dressed in the exam room after the doctor left, the only thought that made her feel even a little better was Mommy and Daddy. Knowing they were in the waiting room comforted her so deeply that she started to imagine everyone in her family surrounding her with love until they became as present as her own heartbeat. She could feel their energy in the room, feel them connected to her by a thick red cord, unbroken by death, space, or time. And the more folks she added, the stronger she felt. Just as she was about to leave the exam room and go out to her parents, she felt a warmth swell through her, up from her feet, as if coming through the floor, flowing up through her body, all the way through her head. Then she felt a voice. Felt was the only way to describe it. Say, "Fear not, daughter of our daughters, we are with you." And she knew that her ancestors were there. Over the years, she imagined a chain that stretched all the way back to Africa to the first mother. She pictured a veritable world of strong, proud, loving, wise black people behind her, and she found that if she spoke to them and listened very carefully, they offered guidance and direction. Right now, she wanted comfort, assurance that the ancestors would be with her during this pregnancy, but she was far from sure they were going to give it. They would have something to say about Nick. She couldn't imagine that Nick would be unhappy about the baby once reality set in, but at first it was going to be rough. He'd been in such a funk after losing his only regular gig. The Nick Campbell Quartet had been playing every Friday and Saturday night for a year at a dive called Bronco Bill's. It didn't pay a whole lot, but it was a steady gig when steady gigs were hard to come by. But 2 weeks ago, the band showed up and the place was closed. No warning, just a note on the door for the bartenders, waitstaff, kitchen workers, and Nick's band. He was still absorbing that blow when his father died. Now he would be doubly likely to take the news about the baby badly. Hopefully he was wearing the silver and turquoise ring she'd given him. It would protect him, as would the burdock root she'd hidden in his bag. She took a small bottle and spritzed herself with lavender water to soothe her nerves. She tried to concentrate on praising and honoring her ancestors, feeling the connection between them and her, and between them and her baby. But the more she thought about how moody Nick had been lately, the harder it was to keep calm. She could sense that the ancestors were telling her not to wait to tell him about the baby. Sooner was better than later for this kind of news, but she was starting to think that now wasn't the right time. She tried to exhale negativity, fear, and doubt, and inhale peace and love, tried to let divine energy flow through her. For double good luck, she crossed her eyes and snapped her fingers 3 times, then laughed at her silliness. Her older brother had taught her to do that when she was little. It had never brought her any luck, but it never failed to make her smile, which was its own kind of luck. Her condition increased her chance of miscarrying, but she hadn't had a lupus flare-up in 3 years, and all without Western drugs, thank you very much. The acupuncture, herbs, diet, exercise, and meditation the ancestors had guided her toward were working. She was healthy. This baby was healthy. Nick loved her, and once he got used to the idea, he would love their child too. And the ancestors would be with her through this pregnancy just as they had been since that dark day in the exam room 9 years ago. She sat on the floor cross-legged, limber from yoga and African dance, her joints loose in remission, closed her eyes and breathed, inhaling and exhaling loudly through her nose in deep ocean breaths. Juju, her cat, rubbed against her legs and purred. They say when ghosts come around, the room goes cold. It was the opposite with the ancestors. When they were near, Billy felt the air around her and the blood in her veins warm. Then she would get a message. The ancestors would speak in one voice, neither male nor female. It was a voice without sound, more like a thought that entered her mind but wasn't her own. Today she felt the familiar warmth spread through her. Trying to control life is like trying to hold water in your hands, was the message she received today. Daughter, tell your man the truth and the healing will continue. Wait too long and healing will slip through your fingers. She knew they were right, but still she worried about what would happen when she told Nick. She prayed for his ancestors, including his father, to help him through his depression, help him see that building a family with her would be a wonderful adventure. When he came home, she would run a warm bath with sandalwood oil and rose petals, and they would bathe by candlelight and make love under the fat moon. In the meantime, she ignored her fears, ignored the ancestors' urgings, and gave attention only to the knowledge that the thick red cord that ran through her would continue. She stood and turned in a circle, lifting her arms and legs, waving her hands in the air in a West African dance. The only drumming she needed was that of Ambata's heart. Thank you.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fode, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Authors on Tour Live has been presented by Belco Credit Union. Belco has been serving members' financial needs since 1936. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks for many more authors as we podcast Authors on Tour.